Well, this just in. The Food and Drug Administration has declared a genetically modified salmon to be fit for human consumption. And chances are we will, whether we know it or not, be eating that salmon sometime in the near future. And so today we pause to ask, are foods re-engineered to contain foreign genes safe to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1036th edition of the Food Chain right here in the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Elias Caius who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What radio with engineer Jason.
My pleasure, sir.
Have a question for you, Jason.
Fire away.
Do you think foods that have been re-engineered to contain foreign genes are safe to eat?
Well, you know, Michael, I think when they want to make it illegal to label those GMOs, I think that's a pretty clear sign right there.
Ah. Well, also with us today, we have Dylan Hunsinger in the studio. Dylan, what about you? Do you, college student, do you think foods that have been re-engineered to contain foreign genes are safe to eat?
You know, I really suspect that 90% of them probably are, but I don't think we'll ever know what the 10% that are not are, and that really concerns me.
Okay. Well, there you go, folks. It did just happen. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, under the direction of former Monsanto Vice President Michael Taylor, has granted the InterExon Corporation, under the direction of former Monsanto President Robert B. Shapiro, approval to sell its genetically engineered salmon for human consumption. InterExon's Aku Advantage branded salmon contains a growth hormone from Atlantic salmon and a genetic switch from an eel-like creature that keeps salmon's growth gene active all year instead of only parts of the year, and thus the fish creature grows to market size twice as fast as wild salmon. Now the Aku Advantage, I love the sound of that, don't you? The salmon, the GMO salmon will be grown in concentrated aquaculture feeding operations and likely fed pellets containing ground fish and chicken wastes and soy and canola. They will be fed, also be fed high concentrations of antibiotics to protect them against concentrated populations of bacteria and food colorings to imbue their colorless flesh with salmon rose hue. Though many supermarkets say they will refuse the Aku Advantage GMO salmon, and many consumers say that it will not eat it, chances are very good everybody who eats salmon will, with or without knowing it, eat the creature. The reason is that much of the salmon sold is sold under false pretenses. Using DNA sampling, the conservation group Oceana studied 82 samples of salmon sold and found that 66% sold through upscale restaurants were misrepresented. In other words, that wild salmon that they said they were selling was actually farm salmon, as was 20% of the salmon sold in grocery stores. And so, if we eat salmon, we will likely eat genetically engineered salmon, fed genetically engineered corn, soy, and canola sometime in the near future. This thought leads us to ask, are foods re-engineered to contain foreign genes safe to eat? Well, here to help us fish around for some answers, we have Sheldon Krimsky, who is a professor of Tufts University and author of a white paper I found called An Illusory Consensus Behind GMO Health Assessment. And he's also editor of The GMO Deception, as well as many other books on the biotech industry. Sheldon, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Good to have you as board as well. Now, as a Tufts University professor of humanities and social sciences, how on earth did you get focused in on the biotech industry the way you have, to the extent that you have?
Well, titles are very misleading sometimes. My early training was in physics, where I got a master's degree and was working toward a doctorate, but then I got more interested in the ethical and philosophical questions, so I switched to philosophy and philosophy of science. And I got involved in modern genetics rather accidentally, you might say, as an area of study that I can ask important philosophical and policy questions. So that's sort of how it happened.
And there you are. So you're asking some very interesting questions these days. And according to the paper that I found, which stopped me in my tracks, was the illusory consensus, which is a interesting question in itself. So is there a consensus?
Well, I did what any good scientist would do when they're trying to understand the weight of evidence or where the scientific community is on a particular issue. And that is, if we don't have 30 years to spend evaluating and reading every single article that has been published, what we do is we look at the systematic review articles. These are articles that are contracted by journals, usually asking prominent scientists or well-established scientists to look at the literature and report what they find from the literature on a particular topic. So I found 8 systematic reviews on the question of the safety, health and safety of genetically modified food. And what these, the only method that they typically use is animal feeding experiments, because they don't do experiments on human beings. So from looking at the...
Not at least in the laboratory, right?
Right, not in the laboratory, right. Not, it wouldn't. So I found 8 systematic reviews, and it showed that these systematic reviews, that they greatly differed on the question of whether or not GMOs are safe. And when you ask the question, are GMOs safe, the first thing is, you have to have a methodology to evaluate the safety.
Right.
Otherwise, it's all speculative. You know, you can all guess. You can. So, and the fact is that there is no widely accepted methodology, protocol for doing experiments. There's no widely accepted universal methodology for testing it. So scientists have been building the methodologies as they go along, and the ones that they typically use are animal feeding experiments. So they feed it to animals for either a short period of time or a long period of time, and then they look for certain things, and different scientists may look for different things depending upon what their field of expertise is. So that's the methodology they use, but there's no universally accepted one. The next question is there a regulatory agency, a regulatory body, that has the responsibility for evaluating these tests and for evaluating the protocols for making these tests? And the answer is no.
No?
There is no regulatory agency.
What about the FDA?
Well, that has exercised its responsibility in this arena. Theoretically, the FDA could, but in 1992 they issued a policy document that says we are not going to regulate foods generated by gene splicing experiments, by foreign genes. We are going to let industry make the call. And that was a fundamental policy issue on the part of FDA.
Mm-hmm.
The Europeans, however, did exactly the opposite and said, we're not going to allow genetically modified food in Europe unless we tested them. So here you have scientific communities in both Europe and the United States, and you have regulatory communities, and they've taken a different position on this.
And so here we have a situation with respect to the genetically modified salmon in which the Food and Drug Administration, which is directed by former Monsanto Vice President Michael Taylor, looking at the information offered up by the InterExon Corporation, which is directed by former Monsanto President Robert Shapiro, and saying, okay, looks good, but there's nobody really doing any research other than InterExon Corporation, and so we're left to believe what they're telling us. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, you know, one of the things that is not clear to me, and
hold that for just a second. I have to take a quick break. Holy smokes, okay. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Sheldon Krimsky and you. We're talking about GMOs. We will be right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, this from the FDA regarding their approval of the InterExon Corporation's genetically modified salmon. The FDA has thoroughly analyzed and evaluated the data and information submitted by Aqua Bounty regarding the Aku Advantage salmon and determined that they have met the regulatory requirements for approval, including that food from the fish is safe to eat. So, it's the government has just elected in 1992 to defer the research or the science on the efficacy of eating genetically modified foods to the companies that make them. Is that right, Sheldon?
Fundamentally, that's correct. There's no mandatory requirements of testing. So whatever testing is done is usually done by companies. They can present their information to the FDA, but the FDA does not have to base its decision on the testing regime because there is no requirement, there's no mandatory requirement for testing for genetically modified plants. Now, that's different for animals. They do have a protocol for genetically modified fish. That is different because they treat, believe it or not, they're using existing laws, and they treat the gene in the fish, the new gene in the fish, as a veterinary drug.
So they have
requirements for testing veterinary drugs in animals, and FDA uses that regulation to test the fish. So what I don't know, and what my colleagues don't know, is what kinds of tests the FDA has done to evaluate the genetically modified fish. We don't know, you know, and maybe it'll all become transparent, but they don't make it transparent what the evidence they've used, what peer-reviewed studies they've used, what studies they've used from the company itself, which have not been published. All of this matters. And the reason this matters is that you have to ask the right kinds of questions when you're looking at the introduction of a foreign gene into an animal or even a plant. of course, the gene functions successfully in one sense. It produces a larger salmon faster.
Right.
Because if it didn't do that, there would not be any economic value in it.
Right.
So that's fairly obvious because that's what the company has achieved. However, we now have mountains of evidence that when you put a foreign gene into an organism, like a plant or an animal, it could have other effects. There are things called gene-gene interactions. It could affect other genes in the system. And until we understand what those effects are or might be, we don't know if the final product is going to be safe.
So in these studies that you're talking about, we're not asking that question then?
I don't know.
I don't know because nobody's telling us.
I don't know because they don't publish all the evidence they've used to evaluate this product. And if they have, I certainly haven't seen it, and I don't know anybody else who has. So maybe some organization will do a FOIA request and say, well, give us all the evidence, the decision-making process that you've used to test the fish. For example, there's many ways that the foreign gene could affect other parts of the fish genome. It could raise the expression of certain very small toxins in the fish that now become much larger because of the interaction of the foreign gene. The thing is that the fish genome is not like a Lego system where you just put a new gene in and it does what you want it to do, namely grows faster and bigger and doesn't affect anything else. That would be what a Lego system is like. It's more like an ecosystem. You put it in and it might have unexpected effects in other parts of the genome. Now, did they do animal tests? Did they feed the fish to animals over a long period of time? It's not clear what they did. Also, there is no standardized, as I pointed out, there is no standardized set of testing that has been approved by professional societies that would be used to approve such a product.
Well, we have a few minutes here before a break, but I'd like to take you back to your study of the studies. You focused on 8 specific system studies.
Systematic reviews.
And did you... They all don't disagree because there's no standard procedure by which they can measure anything.
That's correct.
So and when there is no...
Each of the systematic studies may have looked at... They have selected out from the vast number of studies the group that they feel warrants to be part of their review. They're not all the same studies that they're reviewing. So you're not going to get, each of these studies has selected out what they consider the most important papers to review.
Mm-hmm. That there is no standard scientific studies or approaches by which to look at the issue of safety, does that not open up the whole question to the realm of politics and opinion and economics?
Well, it's politics has played a role in the regulation or the non-regulation of genetically modified products probably since 1980 and beyond, because in the birth of the biotechnology industry, there was a lot of lobbying of Congress not to pass any regulations that would thwart the new industry. They wanted a free rein to produce products and to create wealth without any government regulations. It was started at a time during the Reagan administration when anti-regulatory mood was very strong. So the tradition of don't regulate us has been around now for quite a time, 35 years. And it's only just recently that the executive branch has put out a statement saying, well, we're going to take some of your suggestions, people, for whether we should be regulating biotechnology differently. Well, of course, they don't regulate it much, but so they're after 35 years, they're reconsidering whether they've been doing a good job in overseeing biotechnology.
And yet, you know, the people that they seem to be wanting to regulate are not the people who are doing the regulating.
Unfortunately, that's all too true.
Well, we're going to take a quick break.
They're coming into government from industry. They're going from government to industry, and we know what that revolving door is like.
There it is. When we come back, I want to pick up these studies and look at two of them in particular that seem to be dissenters, seem to be GMO deniers, and talk about them, those studies, their animal feeding studies, so the kind of things we should be looking at, and what did they find when they fed rats GMOs, and what happened to those who conducted those studies as well. I am Michael Olson. This is the Food Chain Radio program. We've got Sheldon Krimsky, who is a professor of Tufts University, also author of a paper entitled An Illusory Consensus Behind GMO Health Assessment, also editor of the GMO Deception. Sheldon, are you a GMO denier?
I think that's...
Well, this from An Illusory Consensus Behind GMO Health Assessment by Sheldon Krimsky, who is on the line with us today. Prominent scientists and policymakers assert with confidence there is no scientific controversy over the health effects of genetically modified organisms, that genetically modified crops currently in commercial use and those yet to be commercialized are inherently safe for human consumption and do not have to be tested. Those who disagree are cast as GMO deniers. Well, are you a believer or are you a GMO denier? The Food and Drug Administration just approved a new genetically modified salmon that will likely be in the market sometime soon. And, you know, folks, when they sell us salmon, sometimes, oftentimes, it's not the salmon that they promise, it's the salmon that they deliver. And if they can grow this salmon twice as fast and cost half as much, I suspect it might just flood the market and we will be eating it. So is it safe? What do you think? 831-479-1080. Sheldon, I kind of tossed a mean one to you, asked you if you were a GMO denier. Are you?
Well, I think that term is used just to keep people from asking questions. And if asking questions is being a GMO denier, then I'm happy to be a GMO denier. But I'm not opposed to genetically modified food or animals in principle. I am just interested in making sure that we have the systems in place to evaluate the safety both to human health and to the environment. And if we can do that, then I'm not opposed to it.
And do we not have the systems in place?
We certainly don't.
We don't.
There's no question. I mean, nobody, and the people who are for GMOs argue we don't need the systems in place. So, you know, I don't think they would argue we have the systems in place. Well, even FDA, which does require testing for genetically modified animals, because, as I pointed out, they view it as a drug, a veterinary drug, even though it's kind of bizarre. But there, no regulations have ever been passed specifically for genetically modified animals or for genetically modified food.
So there you go. So let's take a look at the couple of the studies of animal feeding studies, couple that you bring up that really became quite famous because of the ruckus they created among the scientific community and the industry as well. One of them fed potatoes, GMO potatoes, to rats, and the other was corn, I believe, right?
Correct.
So let's take the potatoes to rats. Tell us a little bit about that study.
Well, the principal investigator of that study, Dr. Arpad Pusztai, Hungarian-born, but worked for many, many years in Scotland at the Rowett Institute, and he is was a senior investigator and has written many, many scientific papers and several books. His expertise was on the proteins in plants that have insecticidal properties. So he knew very well about how those proteins worked and how they worked in plants and how insects avoided the plants with those insecticidal properties, etc. So his company, his institute, and he thought that if they had transferred one of those proteins from a flower with the insecticidal properties, those proteins in general are called lectins. If they transferred that to a potato, well, maybe the potato could grow without insects eating it up, or eating up the, you know, the, mm-hmm. the fruit.
Great idea.
So he thought this is a very intriguing idea. His institute actually had equity in the idea, and there was a company waiting to get the benefits, the intellectual property benefits of it. So there was going to be a win-win situation if it worked. And Dr. Pusztai performed the experiments.
Which is to say he fed the rats the potatoes, right?
Yeah, that was in. And he found out that they had damaged the rats significantly. And his paper was reviewed by six reviewers at one of the most prestigious journals in the world called The Lancet.
Of course.
A British journal. Everybody in the medical community knows The Lancet. And five of the reviewers suggested to the editor-in-chief to publish it, and they did. And it caused a huge controversy amongst people who were, supportive of biotechnology, didn't want to see any negative evidence. So when that support came flooding in to Rowett, the institute fired Dr. Pusztai, basically took him away from his laboratory and just literally dispensed with him. And it was a terrible, terrible thing for him.
And his paper, did they find anything wrong with his study? I mean, with his approach, with his science?
If they found an error in his study, or if they found that he had violated an ethical principle, they could retract it. His study was never retracted.
Oh.
And if people felt that it was a study that maybe accidentally produced those results, then they should repeat it. That's what science does. If you think that somehow his results came out negative by some virtue of some accident, some some variable that nobody considered, then they should repeat the experiment. But they never did. Instead, they just completely destroyed his career.
Essentially, they said, you're telling the truth, we don't like it, you're fired.
Yes, or we don't believe in the results of your experiment, or we can find nothing wrong with the methodology you've chosen, but we don't believe in the results.
Wow. And so when science conducts a study that turns out to be not what you like to hear, you destroy the scientist, I guess. And so that takes us to the Seralini study.
That's not the way science proceeds, though. That's not the way it should
be. It should be. It's not the way it should be, but it was the way it happened in this case. Yeah. And the next case being the Seralini study, which used rats, fed rats, the GMOs. But it was a time study. And so instead of doing the industry standard, what, three-month study, they did a nine-month study. And what did they find? Oh, my goodness, folks.
It was longer than it was a couple of years, I believe.
A couple of years. Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, Sheldon Krimsky, and you were at 831-479-1080. Do you think the GMOs are safe to eat? Well, there are studies. Some say that the GMOs are safe to eat. Others not so certain. Sheldon Krimsky did looked at the eight systematic studies, found how many disagreed with the notion that GMOs were safe. Sheldon?
You know, I looked at eight systematic reviews. Each of these reviews may have looked at dozens of studies. And I also compiled a list of 26 peer-reviewed articles that found adverse effects on feeding experiments. So I reached the conclusion, how can you just dismiss 26 studies? So if you're a scientist that says there's absolutely no shred of evidence that the GMOs can have adverse effects, what do they do with these 26 studies? I've yet to find an answer to this.
Well, they sweep them under the rug. One of them was conducted by French gentleman Seralini. And Seralini's rats. Tell us about Seralini's rats.
Well, Seralini works at the University of Caen, C-A-E-N, in Normandy, France. And he has a background in toxicology of chemicals and food, and he did the study on the animals and found out that the GM maize, and he did the study very carefully to, you know, use non-GM crops and GM crops, and also with the pesticides that were used in conjunction with the GM, which is glyphosate. So he tried to separate the studies very differently and have controls. He found out that his GM maize had adversely affected the mice compared to controls, of course. That means they got more tumors. There were other adverse effects to their organs. And he reported the study in a reputable American journal. That is, publishes studies of industry people as well as people working in universities and institutes.
And the consequence? What happened when Seralini showed pictures of his rats to the world?
Well, his study was reviewed and approved for publication, and then all of a sudden, similar to the Pushchai case, the flood of criticism came from those scientists who didn't want to hear such things. And, of course, a lot of criticism spurred on by the biotechnology industry. And curiously enough, the first response of his editor-in-chief was to the scientific community was, we have a very respected refereed system, and we trust it. In other words, they, by virtue of trusting the refereed system, they trusted the article and its methodology and its outcome.
And what happened?
But then something happened. It took about a year, and the controversy got heightened. And the editor-in-chief of the journal allowed Seralini and his group to respond to criticisms that came in the letters. Mm-hmm. Which is a correct thing to do if there are criticisms.
Sure.
You let the authors respond. And he responded with, it appeared to me, longer responses than the original paper was to begin with. I mean, he took a tremendous amount of time to respond to every single criticism that they made. They literally threw the sink at him. He got some money from a nonprofit. They said that that there was conflict of interest because some of his money came from government agencies, some from a nonprofit. So they claimed he was in a conflict of interest. I mean, they threw everything at him. And we didn't hear anything for about a year. And then after a year, we get the notice from the editor-in-chief that they were retracting his article.
On what grounds?
Without his approval, on the grounds that, and they said specifically, we're not retracting this paper because of scientific error or because of misconduct. We're retracting this article because the results are not definitive.
Uh-huh. And thereafter, the magazine got a new editor, did it not?
Well, yeah, the word is that one of their editors or associate editors was a person who had worked for Monsanto.
And there that, it is. So that's a quick look at
outrageous.
Quick look at two studies. We're going to go to the phones, 831-47-1980. Steve, welcome to the food chain.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was a nurseryman for a few years, and it was really sold to me, these chemical fertilizers. And I didn't realize until later the difference between the chemical fertilizers and organically grown plants. And what I found out about the chemical fertilizers was they kill the natural bacteria in the soil. So no longer do you have a live soil. The plants are growing strictly from the chemicals. And so I was just curious on these GMOs that aren't like just crossbred or propagated that are chemically changed, like what Monsanto does. If you look at the bottom of their page, I think it's Chevron is involved. So it's directly chemically changed. So I was wondering about at what level might those plants, if we get those chemicals through the plants, might affect us, not like getting a tumor or something, but could it cause a skin problem?
We're going to pick that up when we get right back. Thanks for the call. Do stay tuned. Well, question on the table, at what point do these GMOs have an impact on the human body? Anybody know that, Sheldon Krinsky?
Well, I mean, the question really pertains more broadly to the process of agriculture, which not only deals with what modifications are made in the germplasm of plants, but also how the soils are treated and what kinds of herbicides are used. And the caller is correct that when we use herbicides and pesticides on the soil, it does have an impact on soil microorganisms and other life forms on the soil that give the soil its rich and valuable use in agriculture. So there's going to be a trade-off for productivity versus quality and the protection of the soil. The answer to the questions, are GMOs safe, is we don't know.
It's the only answer, isn't it? We really don't know.
No, because we don't have a standardized method for evaluating it, and we don't have an agency that is focused on those evaluations.
Quick question from Dylan.
There you go.
Hi, Sheldon. I just wanted to know, it seems like these studies that are finding negative effects of GMOs are quickly being swept under the rug. And I was just curious, do we actually know how many studies there are out there that are finding these negative effects of GMOs? Do we know what the size of that community is?
Well, I've tried over a period of a year to collect what I could from tracking down review articles, from going into databases and collecting as many studies as I could. And there are clearly more studies that say everything is okay. And there may be, in fact, more studies. But the newer studies are beginning to look at the take a longer view. So there haven't been very long-term studies.
Wasn't that the genius of the Seralini study? So instead of
much longer study. Yeah. For example, if you give animals a dose of arsenic, they can die within a matter of weeks. But there are other chemicals that might affect them that you won't see until you've evaluated the animals at their lives. So and humans as well. We know that there are certain effects on humans that we don't see for many, many years. People smoke cigarettes, and 20 years later, they might be affected. So if you did a short-term study on cigarettes, you wouldn't see any effect. If you did a short-term study on asbestos, you wouldn't see any effect. So sometimes you have to take a long view of these studies, and that rarely has that been done. That was what Seralini had started to do. The Europeans believe that you really have to test these things before you put them out on the market. So there's more funding for studies in Europe than there is in the United States.
And so what are we to do, Sheldon Krimsky? Are we just to eat the am I a GMO denier? I think I am.
First of all, I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert on what are we to do. On a personal level, the only thing we can do to avoid GMOs is to buy organic products.
And with that, we're out of time. Sheldon Krimsky, thank you so much for joining us. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you all for tuning in.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.